A new way of being in the world. It's called commoning.
I like to say it's about a politics of belonging, an economics of sufficiency, and a culture of decommodifying and sharing.
That's David Bollier. He tells us about the new book he co-authored with Silke Helfrich, Free, Fair, and Alive, The Insurgent Power of the Commons. But first, we tackle the toxic state of public discourse and how to clean it up. We talk with James Hogan about the new edition of his book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Has the toxic state of political conversation gotten you down? Are you at a loss to talk with your neighbor or friend who holds political views diametrically opposed to your own? Well, help is on the way. In the second and post-Trump election edition of his book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, James Hogan shows how you can become a more effective and powerful communicator in today's highly polarized and polluted public square. The book explores why facts alone fail to convince and why dialogue, empathy, and reframing arguments in a pluralistic way are better at moving understanding forward and changing minds. Jim Hogan is a public relations expert and the founder of the award-winning blog DeSmog Blog, which debunks climate skepticism and denial. We spoke with him in 2009 about his book, Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. I'm Right and You're an Idiot is out from New Society Publishers. Well, Jim Hogan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me.
You started the book before Donald Trump was elected president, so the problem really didn't start with him, but has it gotten worse with him?
It has. You know, I've updated the book just recently with the second edition that looks at the 2016 presidential election and also the Brexit issue in the United Kingdom. But originally, I wrote the book before Donald Trump, and even before most of it was done before the primaries. I was looking at the kind of polarization and the propaganda around environmental issues, and I was kind of shocked to see it in this bigger fashion with Donald Trump as the election unfolded. But he wasn't really part of it. This has been something that's been going on for a long time, maybe on the climate change front for about 30 years.
You mean the disinformation campaign, right?
Yeah. See, that was one of the things that I learned. Like when I wrote Climate Cover-Up was basically a story about front groups and fake scientists, fake science, and these attempts, propaganda attempts to confuse the public about climate change. And we wrote about the organizations that were funded and the people that, you know, it was all about the Koch brothers and Exxon and all these organizations and people who were basically trying to mislead people about climate science. And I thought of it as misinformation or disinformation, more accurately. So disinformation to me is purposeful. You actually know that what you're saying is deceitful and you're trying to go ahead and pull one over on people anyway. What I've learned with this book is that it's more complicated than that. Propaganda not only spreads misinformation and disinformation, it also polarizes and disorients people. So what's going on is really a bigger, broader effort to try to shut the public square down.
Yeah, you say it involves a whole complex set of variables and elements, and you say that governance or the lack of it is a key factor. I wonder if you could unpack that.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll tell you a story. As I was writing the book, I talked to all of these different people, and one of them was a woman named Karen Armstrong, who is an international best-selling author who writes about wrote a great book about compassion. She won the TED Prize in 2008, and they gave her a couple of $100,000 to make the world a better place. And she took the money and used it to interview religious leaders from around the world to talk about, she was mainly concerned about violence, sectarian violence around the world, mainly religious violence. And so she interviewed these people, and they were talking about what is it that we all have in common, regardless of the religion we belong to. And they came up with this idea that one thing that all religions have in common is the golden rule, that you don't treat people in ways that you don't want to be treated yourself. And so she wrote this book called The Charter for Compassion. And so when I interviewed her about this misinformation problem, she said, we need to speak out against injustice, but not in a way that causes more hatred. And so one of the things about governance, to go back to your question, if people who are involved in government are more interested in demolishing and defeating people on the other side than they are in the truth of the matter, then you have a big, big problem. And that's what we're facing today.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see that every night on MSNBC, which is always focusing on Trump, Trump, Trump. And then, you know, where the candidates, the 2020 Democratic candidates, most of them, perhaps with the exception of Joe Biden, are talking about what they want, what they're for, not what they're against.
Right. Yeah. And it's, I think that it's, you know, politics has always been a rough and dirty business. And I'm not suggesting that somehow we have to stop all that. That's not going to happen. But I think we need to be as good at dialogue as we are at debate. And if it's all about defeating someone who disagrees with us, you're going to get this polarization that drives everybody into gridlock, and then nothing gets done. And so, you know, climate change becomes a hoax by the Chinese. You know, Donald Trump walks out of the UN while the rest of the world is trying to do something about this horrible problem on our horizon, this problem of warming our climate. There's a social pathology at work here. And that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah. And Jim Hogan, one of the things that you say very, very much in the beginning and also through the book is facts and reason are not the way to convince people. And that's one of those dilemmas. I have a lot of problems with that because, you know, just recently, I mean, I get what you're saying. So I want you to explore that with me. But, you know, Greta Thunberg says, unite behind the science, and she's sparked a movement in less than a year that saw 4 million people marching in the streets on September 20th.
Yeah. And so, you know, to be clear about this, what I'm arguing is that facts and science are not enough. And what I mean by that is that the resistance to change does not come from people not understanding the facts. That's not the problem. The problem is bigger and more difficult than that. And it's rooted in this partisan polarization. Nearly all the people that I spoke to in the book talked about the importance of emotional dialogue, the importance of values, that when we tell our stories, and this clearly is what Greta does, you're not going to move people with facts. It's not that facts aren't important. Of course, it's absolutely important that science is telling us this, but it's our values and the emotional conversation that we have with people that are far more important than just trying to clear up people's position just by giving them information. It's not an information deficit problem. Ideology is not factually based. Interesting group at Yale, led by Dan Kahan, they look into something he calls cultural cognition. And that is this problem of motivated reasoning, where if you have a group that believes something and then some evidence comes along that contradicts the beliefs of that group, the tendency is not to change your beliefs to conform to the evidence, but to manipulate the evidence to conform to your beliefs. And so we look for things that support what we believe, and we ignore things that undermine what it is that we believe. And that is the real, that's where the big change resistance is coming from. When I look at the world now, I see, yes, we have this problem of inertia. And so we need to get people motivated, which is the beautiful thing that's been happening with the climate strikes around the world. So this kind of motivation is, that needs to happen. We need to start to bother. But there's another big part of this resistance to change that is this partisan polarization. And you can't have a conversation with that and just clear up that problem with facts. Facts are part of it, but you need to speak to people's values and hearts.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jim Hogan about his book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. And I don't know if it's in your book or just something else that I've been reading, but I think you might have said, you know, we're not going to necessarily get to 100%, we're not going to convince 100% of the people. There are always going to be folks who are going to oppose you with every fiber of their being for many reasons. You know, it might be cultural. It might be because they're, you know, a fossil fuel CEO executive. You're not going to get to them. But that there are a whole lot of people who don't know yet how they feel, or they think they know how they feel, but it's shallow. Those are the people we need to talk with. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we need to learn the skills of speaking to people that we strongly disagree with. You know, just because someone disagrees with you about something that you understand to be a problem and feel strongly about doesn't mean that they're an idiot or that they're evil. Good people can be completely wrong about something and still be good people. And I think there's a fellow that I interviewed for the book who talked about something he called the advocacy trap, where he said that if you don't understand that good people do bad things for good reasons, that you can slip into this advocacy trap where you take a position on something, you advocate for something, somebody disagrees with you and you try to correct them, but they persist. And so you start to question their motives, and you start to think that they're up to something. And before you know it, you're in a battle with, you know, David and Goliath, and good versus evil. And you start to get into this situation where ultimately you can't work with in a community. You can't work with people that you feel are despicable. And so you can actually be right on the evidence and be right on the problem and what needs to be done about it, and be wrong on the methods that you use to try to gather the political base or political agreement that you need to move forward. And that's where we are, right? We have these, right now, there are enough people in the United States who are okay with the fact that Donald Trump thinks that climate change is a plot by the Chinese to undermine American industry. That's a problem. You know, there's enough people to vote him in as president in spite of the fact that he's going around saying something as goofy as that.
So I'm going to pose you a problem. Maybe you can help me through this one. I have a friend who voted for Trump and supports Bernie Sanders, by the way, who is probably the toughest candidate on the Democratic side on climate. He certainly got the toughest climate action program, action plan. My friend is a good person. He is one of the most generous, kind people I know. He does not believe in climate change. He thinks the climate is cooling. He thinks it's all about sunspots. He, you know, is almost exclusively gets his news from Breitbart and that ilk. And he's, all his friends are people like me who are progressives, liberals, who are totally passionate about climate change. I don't think he has any friends on the other side. And he persists in this. And I just batter him with the facts, and he just doesn't believe them. And I'm at a loss. What should I do?
We shouldn't be having these battles over facts. that what we should be doing is talking about concerns and have the heart-to-heart conversation about concerns. There's an interesting woman in Berkeley who's started this group called Smart Politics, and she actually does sessions. You know, I've taken a couple of them, and I think they're quite good. And she tries to guide people past the triggering parts of the conversations like this, and to be aware of how you get triggered and how the person that you're disagreeing with or that you disagree with gets triggered, and how you basically can work through questions and this process of inquiry about people's concerns to find some kind of common ground before you get to the place where you disagree. And I actually think that it takes training. I think we are, one of the things that I've been surprised at is I don't think it's like a simple mistake that we're making. I just don't think we have the skills to have these conversations. It's something you have to really put your mind to, particularly if you're someone who's really good at the debate side of things. Learning how to be really good at the dialogue part of life may be something you have to work at, and vice versa. You know, I think there are a lot of people who are really good at the dialogue part that need to be a little bit better at the debate part, right? And so I think these difficult conversations are super important. These people at Smart Politics argue that if you look back at the history of America and some of the great things that have happened, you know, in the civil rights movement, in the women's movement, in the anti-war movement, even in the environmental movement, that a lot of the progress has come because people figured out how to have difficult conversations over, you know, a Thanksgiving dinner. And either both fight and flight when it comes to these situations are not helpful. We do need to bother about these things. And we can't just not have the conversation with our crazy old uncle. We need to figure out how to do it and how to do it in a way that doesn't make it worse. And I think part of it is understanding where these people are coming from. Now, this whole cultural cognition problem, or the stuff that Jonathan Haidt writes about, that when you engage in this psychology of teams, open-minded thinking shuts down. When you engage in this us versus them way of looking at the world, your frontal cortex, that is how you think, kind of independent of how you feel, shuts down. And so if you're in that part of your brain, that kind of fight or flight part of your brain, that's where the unreasonableness comes from. And that's how tribalism works. But it works on both sides. Even when you're right on the issue, tribalism can be a problem. And so I think trying to figure out ways to find common ground. And there are a lot of people who are really good at this. In fact, I'm starting to interview them for another book. This whole area of dialogue and finding common ground, this whole area, you know, the Dalai Lama talked about in my book, of compassion and warm-heartedness, it is something we want to become a lot better at.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James Hogan about the second edition of his book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. A very important book at this time. And very much the focus is on the climate crisis, because that has been where you have centered a lot of your work in recent years. You know, I want to ask you about another conundrum, which is the one about the frames. How do we talk about the climate crisis? There are a lot of folks who you interviewed for the book who say you can't talk about the gloom and doom. You can't say how dire it is, because then people just get paralyzed. But on the other hand, you can't really not tell people the problem. I mean, I think a lot of people have criticized scientists for many years who actually tried to couch their communication in scientific terms that hedged a lot, and it just wasn't getting across the fact that the situation is far worse than most people think. So how do we stay honest without shutting people down?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what you're talking about there was something Carol Tavris, she's a psychologist. She was the editor of Psychology Today, and she wrote a best-selling book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And she warned against that. And I think there's a huge amount of truth to that, and we have to be very careful. And there was disagreement in my book among people. I'm a bit torn by it. It worries me. The idea that we only have 10 years left, you know, I'd like to know more about that. I don't know who knows, you know, how scientists have come to know that. I'm not sure if somebody is thinking that that's a good motivator. I'm not sure that's true.
Well, actually, Greta Thunberg, you know, says it's actually worse than that. It's 8 years left to have a 50% chance of staying below 1.5 degrees centigrade. And she's pretty careful about her scientific information. And that even does not even include the tipping points that we've already set off. So it's probably worse than that. So, you know, that's why some people say we only have 18 months to start turning this around.
Yeah, what you just described as that Greta says is that to me makes sense. If that's what you're talking about, is, you know, avoiding 1.5. You know, it's interesting, Roshi, I interviewed a woman named Joan Halifax, who's a Buddhist leader in Santa Fe, Zen Buddhist teacher. And she encourages people to face despair, to walk toward it. So she would be sort of on the opposite end of the thinking on this that Carol Tavris is. Carol Tavris, though, is talking about research. And she's basically saying that, you know, psychologists will tell you from all different kinds of research that when messages are crisis oriented like this, that people freeze. And one of the reasons that you need to be hopeful is even when there's a whole bunch of reasons not to be hopeful, is because of this paralysis. And the way I think about it is that you can be headed for disaster and still be hopeful, as long as you think of hope as action. Like, what do we do? What is it that good people should do when we face this kind of problem? There's hope in that. Our hope doesn't have to be like a field of daisies in the future, if that field of daisies doesn't seem possible. But hope can be that this is who I am. This is what I will stand for. This is the kind of person I'm going to be. This is what I'm going to try to do. And there's hope in that. That helps you overcome the feeling, you know, of despair. Thich Nhat Hanh, when David Suzuki and I sat down with Thich Nhat Hanh, had tea with him at the University of British Columbia, and he looked at us and he said, you know, you don't need to tell people they're destroying the planet. They know they're destroying the planet. You need to deal with the despair. And I think part of that is that's a hard thing, but there's a lot of there's psychologists and psychotherapists and psychiatrists and social scientists who are working on this to help people cope. I have a lot of friends who are in despair. And I think we need to look to where we stand on these issues. I think people need to meditate and get exercise. And you're not going to, if you're a mess, you're not going to be very helpful. And right. So you got to take care of yourself. But I do think that you can be hopeful in the face of this kind of disaster.
Well, I always think, it's like the way you start your book, James Hogan, with beginner mind. We actually don't know what will happen. We can see what's happening and we can speculate, but it is possible that something can happen that can change things in time. And so we can't ever give up that. But I want to play something for you. I don't know if you've had a chance. It just happened today. Greta Thunberg addressed the UN the UN today, world leaders at the climate summit. And I want to ask you to listen to something she said, because I actually found it powerful and motivating. It's very much to this idea of hope versus not hope. And I'd like to get your reaction. Could I play that for you?
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
What did you think of that?
Absolutely. Boy, that is unbelievably powerful that a teenager has to be the one who's waking up the adults.
And so why does that give us hope in such a hopeless situation?
I think there's so much clarity about right and wrong there. You know, I think she's so clear. She's so strong. And I think the kind of courage that you see, you know, with a young person who's discovered what's right, and at the same time that they're facing a clear understanding of where we're headed, that's powerful. So there's facts all over what she's saying and behind what she's saying. But what she's saying is all about values. It's all about who we should be and who we are. And it's an emotional conversation. And that's more what I meant about facts. Like, facts are important. It's just that we need more.
Well, James Hogan, your book is just so helpful to those people who want to save this civilization, this planet, and all the beings on it for our children. I'm right and you're an idiot. There's just so much wonderful information in here that can be so useful to us. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you.
Jim Hogan. Go to writersvoice.net to find an excerpt from his book. Next, a book that changes the whole frame through which we see the world, from competition to cooperation. We talk with David Bollier about his new book about commoning. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. My next guest, David Bollier, has come on to Writer's Voice quite a few times over the years. We first talked with him about his book about the corporate misuse of copyright law, Brand Name Bullies. But over the last 10 years or so, he's been working on a world-reshaping project, helping to create a global community of the commons, based on a politics of belonging, an economics of sufficiency, and a culture of sharing. Bollier and his collaborator, German scholar and activist Silke Helfrich, co-wrote the anthologies Wealth of the Commons and Pattern of Commoning. Those books brought the myriad projects throughout the world where people have come together, online, in rural and urban communities, in fisheries and forests, to build collective wealth. Now, Bollier and Helfrich have come out with a new book, Free, Fair, and Alive, that develops a comprehensive vision of the commons with roadmaps and examples to help put it into practice. It's really about a shift to a whole new worldview, new at least to Western capitalist thinking. It's been part of the indigenous worldview and indeed human history for millennia. But in Free, Fair, and Alive, Bollier and Helfrich show how to get to a better world that's possible from where we are today. Well, David Bollier, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be with you.
I see this book, Free, Fair, and Alive, fundamentally as a book of philosophy and, of course, a book of principles on how to common, how to create the commons. But But when I say a book of philosophy, it's because, you know, you write at a certain point, quote, at its most ambitious, Commenting begins the process of reimagining the terms of modern human civilization. So talk about it as a book of philosophy and ontology.
Well, philosophy people associate with something abstract or egg-heady, you know, not something that affects their everyday life. It is a work of philosophy, but it's profoundly influenced by practice. So it's not as if there's a theory-practice split. We derived what we wrote from what we saw in various commons. And we concluded that the mainstream political world and economists have this idea of rational, utility-maximizing, materialistic human beings as the core human ideal for what they deal with. And we all know that that's really kind of a cartoon character, but nobody in economics has really taken much trouble to revise that beyond doing behavioral economics or a few other sub-disciplines that try to tweak the main model. And we decided that we needed to go anthropologically almost to say commenting is the human inheritance for millennia, and that needs to be represented somehow with the inner dynamics. What does it mean to be a commoner in a psychological way, in a social way? And we wanted to sketch out with some details and refinement what it meant to be a commoner as a personal experience.
And I think I said philosophy because I think of philosophy as a guide to living.
Well, there you go, because that's indeed our purpose and goal. And we wanted to sort of provide not prescriptions or a blueprint, but certain touchstones and guidance for what it meant to engage in commenting.
Yeah. And, you know, as I read this book, I thought of this PBS series that I've been watching online. It's The Native Americans. And, you know, one thing that they said is that throughout North and South America, throughout the history of Native American tribes, and throughout the history of many different tribes, the worldview is fundamentally the same, that we are all connected and that humans and nature are inextricably linked. So when you say this is the way we thought for hundreds of thousands of years, it's not just the Native Americans. In fact, Homo economicus is kind of an aberration.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a creation of the past 200 years, which we've made to be normative, that this is the way life is. And it's a bizarre aberration in the long sweep of human history.
Yeah. And, you know, after a week of climate action, I mean, I went into New York City on the 20th and I saw Greta Thunberg speak and I was with 250,000 other people. The signs all around me emphasized this point that you're making, you know. Talk about this worldview that is necessary to really create a post-fossil fuel world.
Well, I think that we wanted to get beyond simply the political or economic or even policy level to a more basic idea of what it means to be a human being. And I think that we have such the term would be methodological individualism. We're so focused on the individual that we don't look at the holistic systemic nature of the problem, or indeed how we as individuals are part of larger collectives. We invented the term the nested I to try to convey the idea that none of us are totally isolated individuals with nothing to do with community, history, biological reality, and so forth. We're nested within those collectives. And once we start to think in those terms, we can start to align our individual needs with the collective needs. And that's sort of the level at which we need to have this discussion.
Yeah, and you call this an onto shift. You have a lot of kind of terms that I had to learn. You're really talking about an ontological shift. So give us some examples of what we're shifting from and to within this context of from the individual to the nested I.
I suppose the first most obvious way of putting it is we're moving from a transactional system of individuals, which is market economics, to a relational system in which we're constantly calibrating our relationships with each other and making those work more harmoniously. because the transactional system really doesn't care about the inner human being or the larger societal stability or harmony. It's simply, can we make that cash transaction? That's what market economics is all about. And as we know, capitalism has invaded every nook and cranny of human life and consciousness and nanomatter and culture, subjecting it to market exchange. So to talk about the commons is to talk about relationships in a more serious way and to honor them. So we have a series of what we call patterns of commoning in which relationships and behaviors are sketched out. So for example, in a commons, it's important to practice gentle reciprocity.
What does that mean?
Well, that means instead of having a strict market exchange or transaction where I'll give you this only if you give me that, we give something to the community or the commons, and in turn, later, indirectly, we get something back. And by having an indirect and gentle reciprocity, we're basically building social connection and bonds and even a certain sense of meaning and emotional resonance that is not present when you have a strict, I'll give you this if you give me that. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of pattern that we see in a lot of commons.
Could you give an example from the book of a system or a project that works that way?
Well, the most familiar to at least we modern Westerners is open source software, where people are contributing code to a shared software project all the time, and they're not even getting money for it, usually, or at least not directly, but they are getting recognition and reputational gain, you might say, but it's not in a strict, I'll give you this code if you give me that. But we see it in all sorts of communities, the Wikipedia community. There's all sorts of urban commons where people collaborate to govern public spaces or libraries or senior centers where nobody's saying, I'll do this, but you have to do that for me. And so the gentle reciprocity is a way to build social connection and make the commons as a social system work.
I'm going to come back to that point, but first I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the terms of shifting from the capitalist system. You know, and I say this because there's a growing sense that capitalism isn't working for us, but people have no idea of what could possibly replace it.
I suppose the biggest difference is we're not looking to the state or law or policy, at least at the beginning, to deliver this for us. This is something we're doing on the ground. And by creating our own commons, we're essentially in our own piecemeal ways neutralizing capital by creating our own circuits of provisioning and governance. So we're not looking to an extremely compromised and corrupted market state system, which is what we call it, to deliver the goods, at least initially. And therefore, it's not going to be a frontal assault on capitalism and then next month or next year, we're going to have something different. It's about eating away at the beast through community land trusts, community-supported agriculture, open source design and manufacturing, agroecology and permaculture, slow food. And I could go on and on about all of these new systems that quite deliberately try to extricate themselves from the clutches of capital, which will inevitably absorb, annex, and corrupt those systems into capitalism. So we see the commons as a you might even say, pre-political way of meeting our needs and self-governing ourselves in inclusive, participatory, democratic ways, in a way that the market state is not likely to do, at least in the short term.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Bollier about his book, Free, Fair, and Alive, The Insurgent Power of the Commons. Yeah, you have an example in the book of this, of a community in Venezuela, actually. Is it Cico Cesola?
Yes. It's a network of cooperatives, which works on a matter of extreme trust. They have consensual criteria for how they run things. And so they have, for example, a massive produce market that goes from the farms to the retail, and they don't work through normal market systems of price. They have a network of suppliers, and they ask those suppliers, well, how much money do you need to meet your costs and then a little bit more? And through the whole value chain, they do this, and then they're able to radically undercut the market by selling at cheaper prices. This is one way that they've created a whole collection of co-ops for funeral services and medical care and many other things that is deliberately withdrawn from conventional market apparatus, but still meets needs in cost-effective ways.
How are they able to provision or supply their goods at such lower cost than the typical market?
Because they have the extreme trust and loyalty of those who participate in it. And the purpose, the point is to take care of people's needs and keep them within the system rather than having them simply sell to the highest bidder and leave. So there's, in other words, a social commitment to the people who participate in the system. And they're not out to price gouge, but to meet needs. So it's a remarkable social system more than a, quote, economic system.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Bollier about the book he co-authored with Silke Helfrich. It's called Free, Fair, and Alive, The Insurgent Power of the Commons. You know, Greta Thunberg, when she was giving her speech, her powerful speech at the UN Climate Summit this past week, she talked about the fantasy of eternal growth. Is Cicco Sassola an example of what's been called a steady state economy, one that doesn't need growth in order to exist?
Absolutely. I would say not just Cicco Sassola, but most commons need growth. They don't have the growth imperative that capital does, because capitalism needs returns on investment, either through equity or through debt. Commons don't. And so you don't see, for example, a community-supported agriculture farm saying, well, we need to wipe out that competitor across town. There's a more collaborative spirit, and there isn't a growth imperative. So a lot of the pathologies of capitalism can be avoided while still meeting people's needs. I like to say it's about a politics of belonging, an economics of sufficiency, and a culture of decommodifying and sharing.
So in this book, Free, Fair, and Alive, you talk about something called the triad of commoning: social life, peer governance, provisioning. So start out with social life.
Well, we find that in most commons, there's certain behaviors in which people have in relating to each other that makes it a successful commons. And I might say that we didn't just theorize these things. We studied scores of commons that we had personally engaged with or witnessed over the past 10 or 15 years. And we found such things as the desire to cultivate shared purpose and values. So there's a lot of talk and discussion for trying to get people through their practices and through their engagement with their fellow commoners to see, oh, we all share this value of, for example, writing the best open source code, or growing the best food we can in this particular bioregion. There's a commoners have to ritualize their togetherness. So they do things that are fun, you know, festivals or parties or other celebrations to show that they are a community. They tend to trust their situated knowing, as we call it, meaning it's not just experts they listen to. They trust what their own practices and history has shown them works in that particular environment. And this is, you know, of course, emulates what traditional peoples or indigenous peoples have known for a long time, who have a very intimate connection with their landscape, and they know it better than some scientist, you know, thousands of miles away, who might know a certain scientific truth, but won't have the relationship with that landscape, and therefore understand its very peculiar cycles and ways of behaving. So these are some of the kinds of behaviors we find in many commons.
We're talking with David Bollier about his book, Free, Fair, and Alive, The Insurgent Power of the Commons. Talk about how this leads to a different view of stewardship and conservation and restoration of nature. You know, particularly you give the example of how it works in protecting forests in Nepal. Tell us about that Commons project.
Yes, well, you have to understand that once you start to open the door to a person's inner life as being meaningful to the external stewardship of something, you start to develop this richer relationship than simply management or property ownership. And again, the indigenous people have a lot to teach us in this regard because they've developed rich traditions and rituals and subjective, quote, subjective knowledge, even spiritual knowledge of their landscape. So in Nepal, they have such rich relationship with their landscape, so they know what makes the forest thrive, how much they can take from it without over-harvesting the wood or the fruit from the trees, what they need to do to pay respect for the landscape. And these are a whole array, repertoire of behaviors that, let's just say, market economics and modernity don't teach us, because it presumes that we're isolated individuals with no ongoing relationships with these systems. So again, the Commons more largely is about developing these deeper relationships and deepening inner knowledge and relationships with the, quote, resources that we manage. And I mean, I struggle on the word resources. I kind of choke on it because a resource implies you can just do whatever you want with it and it's utterly separate from you, which is part of the problem today with climate change and many other problems. So we invented the word care wealth to convey that there's certain wealth that we care about that our own identity and culture is wrapped up in, and therefore it's not something simply to be bought and sold. So these are the kinds of worldview shifts, or as we call it, an onto shift, that we think needs to happen in how we manage the world.
Yeah, I love that term, care wealth. You know, it made me think of how we're struggling to put a price on carbon because it seems to be the only way within the current capitalist system that you can internalize, you know, what is it, these externalities, whereas in your system, there's no internal, external. It's all one.
Well, I mean, I think that's the deeper philosophical revelation we have to come to, that there is no outside anymore. There's no externalities. There's just us immersed in the world. And we have these artificial divisions between us and nature, quote, which is maybe comes from the Enlightenment, which we need to realize that we ourselves are nature. We are embedded in nature, and we need to acknowledge our intersubjective connections with the, I like to call it, the more than human world.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I try to get in the habit of not talking about people and animals, but people and other animals.
Yes. A friend of mine who's a very cutting edge eco-philosopher, we were at a meeting once and we decided to go outside near this river, and he, before we started, gave a blessing to the river. It was kind of a jolt to me, but of course, it was entirely appropriate to sort of acknowledge the generative quality that the river was providing us in our meeting. It sounds very woo-woo and mystical to people, but it's part of developing a respect for nature and then starting to steward nature as if you did respect it.
Now, you have elsewhere and in this book tackled head on the whole idea of the, quote, tragedy of the commons, unquote. You know, we do live in a world in which rules and norms are constantly being broken, actually. Why would they be more robust in a system of the commons while they seem to be so fragile here?
Because the commons engages people at a deeper level of commitment, and it respects intrinsic value, whereas a market culture only respects price as a token of exchange value. How much money can I get for that? And that's the fallacy of the tragedy of the commons theory, that simply that owners of property will respect it more and take care of it better than a shared commons. And the reason why they often don't is because they simply want to make as much money as they can and move on. It's the whole rip and run mentality of capitalism that only respects the price of something and not the intrinsic value, which of course is the problem facing ecosystems today. We moderns do not respect the intrinsic value, the long-term value, the intergenerational value of the more than human world.
But there are nonetheless, you know, issues that you go into more deeply on how this works. For example, how to balance the needs of the individual with the imperatives of the group. I mean, I think this is an issue that arises in any society that tries to create more of a group value. How do you preserve the needs of the individual at the same time?
That's a very good question, because I think it's going to vary from one society and culture to another. We don't regard the patterns of commenting that we describe as universal principles, because in each case, context matters a great deal. The history, the geography, the traditions, and so forth. So modern liberal market societies are going to face a different set of challenges in moving to commenting than, say, communities in Africa, where they've been commenting for millennia. But in each case, I think this is an important struggle that has to be worked out both within a commons and between the state and the commons. You know, in some ways, we're not going to be instantly moving to a commons-based society in the U.S. or Europe. And so we're going to have to find ways in which the state can be enabling of commoning and find ways for the group and the individual needs to become aligned. And I think that's the challenge. It's an evolutionary challenge of becoming, and it's not going to be come from on high from some enlightened leader. It's going to be a group process by which we discover it. And the good news is we mentioned maybe 70 or 80 different commons in our book, in which this has largely been done, where people's individual interests in managing a nature reserve, in managing land that has been acquired, managing co-housing or community forests or online systems in a city, many, many of these things, people's individual needs tend to drive it. And then the community comes to govern that so the individual needs are best met. This is very different from a market system or the market state system, where the large capital holders and reinforced by the state using the power of law, basically declare top down, this is the way it's going to be. So by having an evolutionary bottom-up system, you tend to respect and enact people's individual needs as part of the collective.
And yet it still seems that commoning would be very threatening to the market, the state market system. And if it got big enough, there would be a real pushback. So, you know, how do we scale this up in a way that, you know, where it can take over the world?
Well, the first good news is you don't need to scale too large. Just remember how Linux, the open source computer operating system, had a fraction of 3%, 4%, 5% of usage when it got started, and it had Silicon Valley, particularly Microsoft, really scared, which was calling it communism. Mm-hmm. So you can have just a few percent, because if you have a few percent that is a functional alternative, it scares the big players, the corporations, because somebody can still meet their needs without being locked in and dependent on them. They found an alternative to the market. They're developing their own non-market circuits for meeting needs and governing themselves. That's what open source did. That's what the slow food movement did. And there's a number of other areas where you're essentially neutralizing capital in piecemeal ways by withdrawing and creating your own system for meeting needs. So in terms of scaling, I don't like to use the term scaling because it implies centralized hierarchical top-down systems. But so the term we use is emulate and federate. you keep the appropriate scale, you emulate others that are doing the same thing, and then you federate in loose ways so that you can co-learn and coordinate and move forward the way a swarm might. But you're not, what shall I say, a uniform hierarchical system as such. So that's the way I see it scaling, as well as through certain strategic partnerships with the state, where there can be infrastructure the state can provide, or certain partnerships in which, instead of public-private partnerships, which we know are just kind of a ripoff of taxpayers in many cases, you can have commons public partnerships where the state is facilitating the formation of commons by giving technical or financial or legal assistance, but then people have their own responsibilities and entitlements for running it, sort of like volunteer firefighting operations.
Except that, you know, Linux is still just a tiny percent, and we're talking about a system that needs to actually supplant the current one. So I guess that's what I wonder. I mean, how do you create that inflection point where the commons becomes the default way of doing things?
Well, partly this is the frontier that we're exploring, but partly it's going to have to come through political action and using the powers of the state to enable commoning. But in other ways, we are seeing it with a lot of commons-based finance, where people get together to have crowdfunding of either through gifting or equity of things that belong to them. And unlike open source software, which the tech world has learned how to leverage and co-opt because its code is always freely shareable, and in that respect is not truly a commons that can control it fully, a lot of agricultural commons, fisheries, finance, and others have been able to create their own protectable systems so they cannot be, the fruits of them cannot simply be used by capitalism. But, you know, you raise a good point. This is not an easy solution, but it is, I think, a hardy, protectable model for building alternatives that are not simply absorbed by capitalism. Or, you know, we have a lot of, you think of the great Ben and Jerry's of the world that ultimately sell out to a Fortune 500 company, and they still have the posture or pose that they're socially transformative, but it's all for greater profits for that enterprise.
You know, when I first met you, you were just beginning this exploration of the commons, and when you were into it for maybe a year or two, I remember you telling me that you were working on an international legal framework for the commons. And yet earlier in this interview, you said, you know, we're really not talking about the law or politics yet. So I wonder if that represents a shift to you, or, you know, where does international law come in, and where will it have to come in to promote the commons as the new paradigm?
That's a good point. There's no evading state power or law. It's just that I think given the contemporary politics, we need to build the practice and culture first. And as these commons get big enough, invariably they bump up against existing law, and existing market players see them as a threat and try to shut them down, the way in Europe they've shut down seed sharing as a legal way of developing non-market seed.
What?
Yes, there's prohibitions against selling seed that or sharing seed that hasn't been approved. You know, so this is going on all the time. There's an open source seed initiative that's combating this market state problem, the enclosure of the commons. But my point is, there's no avoiding developing laws that can respect the commons. The point is, doing it now is often politically too big of a stretch. People don't understand the commons to appreciate it enough. So I think what has to happen first is to develop these functional alternatives. And then as they reach a certain scale, they'll have a constituency, and they'll start to realize that they need to change state law. But that's, you know, that's for another day from a position of greater power than we have right now.
So do you see the commons spreading, or is it just a situation where the commons has been being enclosed for several hundred years? Is that beginning to change? Is the balance beginning to shift? And give us some examples of how you see that happening, if you see that happening.
Well, in the U.S., it's not as robust as in Europe and the global South. I just got back from a two-week book tour in Europe and UK. And for me, it was almost like field research, learning about what's going on. There's some PhD students who are starting to organize an international network of commons scholars. There's, in Amsterdam, some people who are seriously studying commons-based finance alternatives that can avoid the debt equity traps of capitalism and have community-embedded systems without compound interest requiring growth. There's a lot of natural resource commons and fishery commons that are being developed as well. And I think urban commons, as a way to fight the invasion of Airbnb and global speculation in housing in cities, is quite pronounced in Amsterdam and Barcelona and Seoul, Korea. So there's a lot of areas where, as not only capitalism and austerity politics have failed, but socialism has failed, such as in Greece or Italy or Spain, where the commons is being embraced as, you might say, a staging area for working out some of these alternatives to party politics and the usual policy-driven approaches. But I will say it's still very much a work in progress and not quite mainstream in many circles. But when you have the French Development Agency seriously looking at the commons as a new way to help its Francophone partners in Africa, you know, you have a lot of signals like this that the old style Western development models of consumerism and market approaches, people are saying, you know, we need to find some alternatives. So that's what keeps me encouraged that there's something here to be developed more, and especially in the U.S.
Urban commons?
Urban commons is a way for a lot of people in big cities, or even smaller municipalities, to try to use the levers of government to empower greater control by the people who live there. There are entire neighborhoods in Amsterdam, for example, that are being hollowed out by Airbnb. Well, why can't we have limits on that, or even municipal platforms for running Airbnb or Uber that use some of the benefits of that to benefit the actual residents, as opposed to just simply allowing international capital to buy up entire blocks and turn them into rental housing for tourists. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a lot of efforts to reclaim the city, the so-called right to the city, that's happening, that is using the commons as a way to assert their interests as against the wealthy, the affluent, and speculative capital.
Well, David Bollier, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. We've had you on the show a number of times talking about the commons. I think this book, Free, Fair, and Alive, The Insurgent Power of the Commons, is a very important book. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show, and I look forward to, you know, more commoning in the U.S.
David Bollier. There's more to our conversation about the book he co-wrote with Silke Helfrich, Free, Fair, and Alive, at writersvoice.net. You can also find links there to chapters from the book, as well as free downloads of their other books about the commons. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.